This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Dr. Julian Araghi is a senior lecturer at the University of Newcastle School of Creative Arts. Joins us on the program this morning. Hi, Julian.
Hello, Trevor.
Julian, I find this fascinating. Children that have been, I was going to say used, but have participated in theatre and vaudeville for such a long time, and the number of theatre productions that there were.
Yes. I think one of the things this is surprising, but also I think the background to it is that Australia in the late 19th century had a very vibrant theatre industry. It wasn't a cottage industry, and Australian entrepreneurs were importing actors and troops from overseas, from the United States and from England, and this was serving to sort of liven and develop Australia's theatre industry as well. So children participated in this quite fully.
Well, because I said before that I remember Bill Kerr saying that he started in theatre with his mum bringing him on stage as a baby, as a live prop, and he felt that that was the start of his career in acting. Was that a common thing for adult actors to use their kids?
It is a story that crops up quite a lot in theatre histories, yes. And it reflects what would have been, for centuries, the traditional practice for children to be trained into the theatre, if that was what their parents did, either as actors or perhaps, you know, even working behind the scenes in the theatre. So this is not an uncommon story, actually. I've even heard of children sort of being secreted on stage under tables or behind chairs as a form of babysitting as well for their parents who were actors.
And I presume that's because these were touring troupes and touring groups, so it was a family affair, and quite often the children would be incorporated in all sorts of ways.
Yes, that's right. And in Australia, to be a theatre performer, to be an actor, was largely meant touring, because whilst the industry was burgeoning and growing in Sydney and in Melbourne, our two theatrical towns, it was unlikely that all actors could get all their work in those two cities. So touring was part of the professional. Well, it was part of their profession, and it was touring the Australian and New Zealand region. So it's very, very common to see the touring troops crossing the Tasman and, of course, going to Tasmania as well. So it was this whole region, Australia and New Zealand, that was the ground, basically.
When you take a look at that, was it that there were children coming up and being trained through these groups that could then take on roles within the theatre, within the productions, or was it that they were making theatre for the children, or the children happened to be there?
I think it's all of those things. Most of my research begins around 1879, because that's when I identify in the historic records that quite suddenly there are troops comprised solely of children. So they've got adult producers, of course, adult writers, musicians, but troops comprised of children. Now, this is crossing over at the same time with children that were born to theatrical families and were trained from an early age. So two young girls, Lily and Rose Dampier, in the late 1870s, their father was the extremely well-known actor-manager Alfred Dampier. So it's not surprising that they start appearing on stage in quite main stage productions from the age of 5, 6 onwards, and went on to have adult careers as well. But around 1879... Australia starts producing quite a number of troupes solely comprised of children. First one was Maclean's Troubadours. Sometimes they called themselves Maclean's Young Australians.
Yeah.
And from what I can tell, they were a mix of children whose parents were already in the theatre and children who were not coming from a theatrical background at all. But a year later, Something else happens. There's a family called Pollards. They had masses of children, even more children than the Von Trapp family. And they produce a production in Tasmania of the children's pinafore. So it's the Gilbert and Sullivan HMS Pinafore, so musical comedy performed by their children. And this, in fact, was a global phenomenon around that time, both in England and the United States, coming out of Philadelphia and New York. And we see the same thing happening in Australia. And in fact, these children's troupes, under the name of Pollards, but other producers as well, remained a feature of Australia's theatrical industry for 30 years, up until 1910.
So did they not only adapt adult theatre or adult musicals, did they have productions that were written specifically for children as well?
Originally, not at first, no. So this is the extraordinary thing, I think, that adult repertoire by Jules Offenbach and also by Gilbert and Sullivan, which for anyone who's listening, they would know this is very difficult music to sing.
It is.
I mean, it's very difficult music to play. It takes, you know, very good musicians to play it well. But to sing it is, you know, it's tough repertoire. It's got a big musical range. So the children were being trained to this repertoire. So we have to say, well, they had skill. They had natural talent. And they were being trained on the job as well.
Because that's what I was thinking, but it's not only the ability to sing it, it's the learning the lines, it's the coordination, it's the dancing. There's a whole stack involved in those productions.
Absolutely. You know, it's what's now called the triple threat, you know, the performers who can sing, dance and act really well. So I'm assuming many children were called, a lot less were chosen. But to go back to your earlier question, I see a real shift in the repertoire about 10 years later, certainly by the 1890s. The repertoire has shifted for children. So the sheet music that was printed from that era that's specific to child songs that were being sung and performed, either in pantomime or in variety, vaudeville, I note there's a real shift in the repertoire. It's within an octave range, so the natural range of a child's voice. So there is a real shift occurring, and children required much less within that 10, 15-year period to be performing that very difficult repertoire of the adults.
Julie, I've got this feeling about it like a children's sweatshop, and but in theatre. In that, because it's a lot to learn, a lot to learn quickly, and over a long, I don't know what period of time they'd have to learn it in, and whether or not they were, like, there was a, if they were forced to do it or they were whipped into submission to make it happen.
I don't think you can make children sing and dance and perform well if they don't want to do it. Hmm. And if they can't do it, you know, they simply don't have the skills. And remember, this was being produced for a commercial environment. So people buying tickets was what kept the companies going and staying on the move.
I've seen some pretty harsh theatre mums.
Well, the theatre mums, I think, have been with us for a long time. Look, there are stories that emerge from some of the touring troupes. For example, Pollards and some of the other troops that toured, they would contract children for up to 2 years. And this is throughout the 1880s. They'd contract children for up to 2 years. Sometimes there would be two or three children from the same family. And in interviews, they would say that, yes, some of these children did come from very poor families. Mm. So it looks very much like the children were given to the theatre company, perhaps because there was hardship at home and it was very difficult to feed so many mouths at home. So there is certainly evidence to justify that with these larger troops. There's also a few stories of I wouldn't, well, brutality, I think that's probably too strong a word, but yeah. Certainly physical harshness, definitely. So we can't deny that. But at the same time, in the same way that you can't, it's a strange analogy to make perhaps, but in the same way that you couldn't teach an animal to do something it really didn't want to do, again, I don't think this is a great analogy.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean, though.
But certainly children that weren't talented, that weren't able to sing and fall into the fairly fairly strict routines of the working days, wouldn't have been contracted or would have been sent home. Yeah.
Yeah, I get that. Chrissy, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Gillian.
Good morning.
I loved Shirley Temple, of course. Such a natural talent. And her tap dancing, singing, and even her just acting was so infectious. I remember one lovely sequence when she was with an Indigenous American black guy, and she was just so clever. She came from parents with a vaudeville and acting career, did she? I think
she... I should know the answer to that, and I'm not sure that I do. I know that she had a very strong mother behind her, pushing her through that studio system of the 1930s.
Yeah, and I think that they may have. It's one of those, because we should point out that your expertise is mainly taking a look at Australian history within vaudeville and also within theatre. But it's an interesting one because I think that she did.
It's very likely. It's very likely. There are very good biographies of Shirley Temple, and in fact, you know, that era of the 1930s, the child of the family movies of the 1930s, reflect and retell a lot of the stage plays that were very popular in the 1890s in the United States as well. So this fascination, the interest with child actors seems to be quite cyclical. It sort of comes and goes throughout theatre and then film history as well.
I was interested to read also, Gillian, that they travelled overseas.
They did. They travelled extensively. So the Pollards, I'll go back to speaking about the Pollards and then I'll talk about some other instances. But they toured throughout the Southeast Asia region. The troops that were in production for up to 30 years, as I said, toured Australia and New Zealand, but then toured to the Straits Territory, so what we know as Singapore, Malaysia, to India and Rangoon and Burma. So these were very long journeys that they made. Early 1900s, troops were also sort of crossing the Pacific. So we have the Pollards in the state of Washington and Seattle in the early 1900s as well. But even within Australia, the companies with children in them would tour, of course, from coast to coast. So in that first decade of the 1900s, we've got young actresses like Rosie Fitzgerald and Queenie Williams touring right across Australia, then up, going overseas as well with a company that was actually entrepreneured out of India, so Maurice Bandman's company. They travelled really extensively.
Who were the children themselves paid? Was the family paid? How did that work?
That sort of information's been very difficult to find. Yeah. Again, back to Pollards with those very early touring troops of the 1880s. I think for poorer parents, it was very attractive. The money was paid to them at the start, and they were told that within the contract, their children would be fed and they would be clothed. They would be given a very small weekly allowance, but the money was paid to the parents. So that would have been attractive, I think, for some parents.
And for that time, that's not bad.
Look, it's not bad if that was what really happened.
Yeah.
So sometimes it happened, and sometimes perhaps the contractual obligations weren't met. But sort of moving on from those large troupes with large numbers of child performers on stage, there were also leading entrepreneurs in Australia who by the late 1880s, early 1890s, were featuring child actors. So J.C. Williamson, who began the Williamson Theatrical Company, which eventually became at one stage one of the largest theatrical producers in the world. That was after his death in 1913, but nevertheless it was a very powerful organisation. So he ran theatres, major theatres in Sydney and Melbourne, and by the late 1880s, there was something like 71 children employed at the Theatre Royal in Melbourne, which is quite a large number for our population at that time. And following patterns in London and New York in the industry there as well. So I guess the children, for the most part, were used in stage pictures. He was also had a ballet and dancing training sort of facility within the large organisation by the 1890s. But some star children were thrown up out of this, and they would appear in dramas, so what we would say stage dramas, theatrical pieces, but also in pantomimes. So he produced spectacular annual pantomimes where there'd be up to 300 people in the cast. But some children would be given starring roles, singing, dancing, and with the rise of variety or vaudeville theatre in Australia, I've started to see that these children moved easily between the Tivoli circuit, which had its beginnings in the early 1890s, and Williamson's productions as well. So this is a really different tier of theatrical production to the touring troupes that I mentioned earlier. This would be the highest echelon of theatrical production in Australia. Children from the age of 7 and 8 are being employed within this network as well. So this is telling us, I think, something quite different about the children that were being employed by Harry Rickards, who ran the Tivoli circuit through Australia and New Zealand, and J.C. Williamson.
What sort of a role did they play in vaudeville? Because vaudeville was quite adult in a lot of ways as well.
It was, but vaudeville or variety, called different names in different countries, was always looking for the family patronage. So it needed to be clean and respectable. So the children were, for the most part, female. I've come across very few young male performers. They're mostly young girls. They sang songs. They danced. They might have done clog dancing or other forms of dancing. And the third thing that they were very, very often doing was impersonations of adult performers. So impersonations of really quite well-known adult performers.
I've got this funny image of a child doing Maureen.
But I think there was a real juxtaposition,
yeah.
I think, between the small, delicate, usually very beautiful young girls doing impersonations of male and female performers. So it's comedy. It's a particular type of comedy that was clearly fashionable at the time. I wonder sometimes if we saw it today, would we still laugh at it? But then when we look at things like America's Got Talent and consider how many surprising young children appear on these global Got Talent shows, I think that's a really good indication of what child performers have been doing since at least the 1890s.
That's a really good point, because it really hasn't changed in some ways.
I don't think it has changed that much. And I think it's not that I've watched the Got Talent shows a lot, but seeing some of the child stars that have been thrown up by Simon Cowell's sort of global program, really, has provided me with a bit of insight into, oh, clever children. This is what the clever children of the late 19th and early 20th century stages may have been like.
All you have to do is watch the ads for the Got Talent shows. That's all you need anyway. Vic joins us. Hello, Vic.
Hi there, Trevor. Look, one of the things I've been wondering is, the fact that a large part of the population couldn't read or write English, or whatever language, I suppose, but did these kids get any education, and were they able to read their own parts, or were they sort of taught by telling them, or, repeatedly telling them?
Rote.
Yeah, look, that's a really good question. One thing that comes through in the historic records that I've been researching is that these children were intelligent. I think, they would have had to have been. Yes, they would have had to have read their parts. The larger troops insisted that they had a schoolmistress travelling with them, and that each part, for a part of every day, they did school lessons, so basic reading, writing, arithmetic. I think travelling the world in the way that they did was probably its own form of education. Also, mixing a great deal with adults who were engaged in the culture industry, which is an education of itself. So based on the records, yes, they were educated according to the standards of the day. Actually, Australia's education laws started to really, I think, have an effect, probably not a strong effect, but an effect in the 1880s. In those days, children had to go to school half time. So they didn't go for a full day, but for half days. And even in the early 1880s, quite major theatre producers taking account of that. So there was a very well-known actress who was married to a very well-known theatre manager. Her name was Mrs. Rose Lewis. They were based in Melbourne, and they owned the Bijou Theatre there. And as early as the sort of 1880, 1881, Mrs. Lewis was training girls and boys at the theatre throughout the week. But she took account of their half-day mandatory attendance at school. So they'd go to the theatre in the afternoons, and the girls, I think, would go on Tuesdays and Saturdays, and the boys on Wednesdays and Fridays. And she would teach them elocution, what else, dancing, stage movement, so they could, move well on stage.
So they were taught the art of theatre as well as the education in the formal sense in reading and writing and arithmetic.
Yes, well, that's right. And in the case of Mrs. Lewis in Melbourne, the children would have been doing their normal school studies, but with her learning dancing, elocution, and stage movement.
Was it thought of as a career for children at that time, or was this in some ways, because we're going back, because we're talking about touring troops, or was it considered like a career? This is what you can do for a living.
I think very much so.
It wasn't a novelty.
Both strands are coming through, Trevor. So there was some kind of uproar in Melbourne, some kind of political complaint that children were appearing on the stage in the evening at the Bijou, and why were they appearing on the stage rather than being at home tucked up in bed? And then there were quite a strand of letters written to the editor of the Argus in Melbourne by parents of these children who said, yes, but this training has made them healthier, has made them more socially adept. It's very good for their health, and they're also getting their schooling. So the sense of it being a very good thing for them to do to develop the full child, the full person, and not necessarily being trained, for a career. But the facts are that quite a number of these children did go on to have careers throughout their teenagehood and then into adulthood as well. So both strands were true, but it was good social training in the same way that today we have children going off to drama classes after school, going to the conservatoriums to learn music. Lots of children learn dance as well as learning sports. So I think this has been very surprising for me to see these trends much earlier in our cultural history than I would have expected.
Sounds like an occupational health and safety issue to me.
Oh, well, you know, these days. These days, the rulings around children in theatre on film sets are very, very strict.
It's true.
In those days, not so strict.
Jen, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Trev. It's interesting to hear this because I was doing family history research for a friend and I discovered the family was Brunswick-based around the turn of the century, but Auntie Grace, as a teenager, somehow ended up in New South Wales in one of these touring troops.
Mm-hmm.
And your health and safety question is quite valid because she ended up giving birth to a child, and allegedly the father of the child was the fellow who ran the troop.
Mm.
And we didn't know anything about this. We knew she had a child before her children that she had when she was married. So there was this boy who was much older than them. But my research led me to find the scandal of this girl becoming pregnant in the Sydney papers, and I found that thanks to Trove.
Mm-hmm,
and
yes.
It was fascinating to read all of this. So I do wonder about the exploitation of kids.
I think you have to. I mean, you know, this is always one of the questions that comes up around the research I've been doing. Unless it's in family history, it's very rarely recorded in the newspapers. Or in journals. So the story you've told, there are other stories that crop up, particularly with, of course, girls in mid to late teenagehood. I guess one of the questions I'm often asked is have I uncovered abuse of children? And the answer is, not sexual abuse, because that wouldn't have been reported.
That's the difference, isn't it? That it's not that it doesn't happen, but the reporting at that time is almost non-existent.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So it was a case in 1910. It was a very famous case at the time in India. It was one of the Pollard's troops in India, and the children were fed up with being hit. If they couldn't reach the high notes, they had their hair cut off, and they wrote letters home to parents in Australia. Anyway, the politicians got hold of it, and it resulted in quite a significant change in Australia's laws in 1910, so it's federal law, and the law was that children could not be exported again for the sake of performing in theatrical productions. There was scandal because one of the 17-year-old girls was living in a sexual relationship with the producer of the company, and he was already married. So clearly these sorts of events did unfold, but very, very rarely is anything reported actually in the newspapers. So it's always a question I can't say talk much to, other than, you know, the research that I've found. So,
Jen, thank you. I wanted to, were there talent spotters that would go around? Because I think at the same time as we're talking, there were all sorts of reviews and shows. There were circus performers where children were involved. Mm. There were all sorts of things happening at around the same time. So were there spotters that would go and find talent?
That's a really good question, Trevor. What I'm seeing is that we have trainers, stage trainers, by the 1890s, well established in Sydney and Melbourne. So they were themselves performers. So they knew the industry. They had very strong contacts with the industry and with producers, or, you know, people functioning in the role of what we now call producers. There were also agents. So I would say there's a network of agents and producers and trainers that were very well connected. So if the trainers in Sydney or Melbourne had some particularly strong children, you know, good singers, good dancers, good personalities coming through, I think they'd make it known, and then the network would sort of kick in. And because there's trainers working, that means there's parents with money to pay them. Mm. So by the 1890s, I don't think it's poor children or impoverished families that are behind the prominent children child performers of that period. I think it's more a sort of middle class. Parents who were in work could afford to send their children to these classes after school. And in many cases from the 1890s, early 1900s, we see the pattern of one or other parent actually travelling with their child. So impoverished families couldn't have done that. This is an indication of families with a sort of financial, at least they're stable financially, put it that way, I think.
It's well documented, or the idea that from vaudeville, we saw a lot of people going from vaudeville into radio and then on to television.
Yes.
Did we see that happening with some of the younger performers as well who went through vaudeville?
It almost goes beyond the period that I've really been focusing on. I guess the other thing to remember with children too is they grow up really quickly.
It's true.
they're actually children for quite a short time. And for some of the young girls, and actually the young boys as well, by the time they're around 14, they probably didn't look like small children anymore. In that sort of grey area, that transitioning from childhood to adulthood. But I have heard of children whose names elude me, but certainly working in radio in the 1930s. It's something I'd like to investigate a little bit more in the future.
Were there stars? Were there children that were that well known that they were almost stars within their own right, within theatre and vaudeville at that time?
There were a few. Again, some whose stars blazed brightly for a short time and then they sort of disappeared. Fanny Powers was very well known on the Rickards Tivoli circuit. I think she may have been a young girl who looked younger than she actually was, but she performed until she was 23.
Wow.
She married at the age of 23, and then this is also a very common story. If a young woman married, she frequently disappeared from the entertainment industry unless she married within the industry. So she was quite a star, and I think one of the ways I can tell that is that there's sheet music that was produced that featured her on the cover. So this song as sung by Miss Fanny Powers or Little Fanny Powers on the Tivoli circuit. So that's an indicator of how very well known she would have been in these centres of Melbourne and Sydney. We also exported children overseas, child stars, although we didn't import any into Australia. Interestingly, the entrepreneurs of the day did not bring child stars into Australia. But little Al McGray, who worked also on Rickard's Tivoli circuit, carved out quite a strong career in England, while still a child, still in early teens, working in pantomime but also working in music hall and variety in England, working with top-tier variety artists at the leading variety houses in the UK. So she did very well. And then some of them just moved overseas and had quite good adult careers in the United States as well, and in England. So there are many, many different sorts of stories emerging.
I love how they had the name Little and find little. That they're all little someone.
Well, often in my research, that's how I identify children on the programs, was that they were called little.
Yeah.
Because there's not a lot of photographic evidence, but photographs are also very good at identifying a child as distinct from a young adult. But it's actually in the programs. it's the moniker of little so-and-so, little Alma Gray, little Fanny Powers, or baby. Some of them were called baby. So we have baby Watson, baby Nichols, who was still being called baby Nichols at the age of 18, a sort of suggestive of, you know, the infant phenomena from Dickens's Nicholas Nickleby, still being called baby at the age of 18, which seems incredible, really.
Gillian, was this the height of that particular period in drama with children? You're saying you're researching from 1879 to 1914. Did it then die off?
Yes, to a certain extent, because of the education laws, and I think that's the main. They became pretty tough. You know, I mean, up until, let's say, World War One, which also shook society so extraordinarily. There were rules about children not appearing after 9 a.m. on the stage, so they were in place, in the 1880s, but many theatrical producers just completely ignored them, and there's stories of the police coming on stage, or one child performing a role up until 9 o'clock and another slightly older child performing the same role after 9 o'clock in the same show, which audiences sort of just accepted and the journalists kind of laughed at. But Australia's education laws became tougher and tougher and more insistent after 1900.
Gillian, our news is coming up. Thanks for telling us a bit about it. It's a fascinating story, and I'm sure one we're going to hear more about as you're writing a book called Pinafore Prodigies and
Precocity.
The news is coming up. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, thanks, Trevor.